and Jaime would only laugh.
"You are a young man, Tyrion," Mormont said. "How many winters have you seen?"
He shrugged. 8, 9, I misremember.
"And all of them short?"
"As you say, my lord." He had been born in the dead of winter, a terrible, cruel one that the Mace has said had lasted near 3 years. But Tyrion's earliest memories were of spring.
"When I was a boy, it was said that a long summer always meant a long winter to come. This summer has lasted 9 years, Tyrion, and a tenth will soon be upon us. Think on that."
"When I was a boy," Tyrion replied, "my wet nurse told me that one day, if men were good, the gods would give the world a summer without ending. Perhaps we've been better than we thought, and the great summer is finally at hand," he grinned.
The Lord Commander did not seem amused. "You're not fool enough to believe that, my lord. Already the days grow shorter. There can be no mistake. Aemon has had letters from the Citadel, findings in accord with his own. The end of summer stares us in the face."
Mormont reached out and clutched Tyrion tightly by the hand.
"You must make them understand, I tell you, my lord. The darkness is coming. There are wild things in the woods, direwolves and mammoths and snow bears the size of aurochs. And I've seen darker shapes in my dreams."
"In your dreams?" Tyrion echoed, thinking how badly he needed another strong drink. Mormont was deaf to the edge in his voice.
"The fisherfolk near Eastwatch have glimpsed white walkers on the shore."
This time, Tyrion could not hold his tongue.
"The fisher folk in Lannisport often glimpse merlings."
"Denis Malister writes that the mountain people are moving south, slipping past the Shadow Tower in numbers greater than ever before. They are running, my lord. But running from what?"
Lord Mormont moved to the window and stared out into the night.
"These are old bones, Lannister, but they've never felt a chill like this. Tell the king what I say, I pray you. Winter is coming, and when the long night falls, only the Night's Watch will stand between the realm and the darkness that sweeps from the north. The gods help us all if we are not ready."
"The gods help me if I do not get some sleep tonight. Yoren is determined to ride at first light."
Tyrion got to his feet, sleepy from wine and tired of doom.
"I thank you for all the courtesies you have done me, Lord Mormont."
"Tell them, Tyrion. Tell them and make them believe. That is all the thanks I need."
He whistled and his raven flew to him and perched on his shoulder. Mormont smiled and gave the bird some corn from his pocket. And that was how Tyrion left him. It was bitter cold outside. Bundled thickly in his furs, Tyrion Lannister pulled on his gloves and nodded to the poor frozen wretches standing sentry outside the commander's keep. He set off across the yard for his own chambers in the King's Tower, walking as briskly as his legs could manage. Patches of snow crunched beneath his feet as his boots broke the night's crust, and his breath steamed before him like a banner. He shoved his hands into his armpits and walked faster, praying that Morrick had remembered to warm his bed with hot bricks from the fire. Behind the King's Tower, the wall glimmered in the light of the moon, immense and mysterious. Tyrion stopped for a moment to look up at it. His legs ached of cold and haste. Suddenly, a strange madness took hold of him, a yearning to look once more off the end of the world. It would be his last chance, he thought. Tomorrow he would ride south, and he could not imagine why he would ever want to return to this frozen desolation. The King's Tower was before him, with its promise of warmth and a soft bed. Yet Tyrion found himself walking past it towards the vast pale palisade of the wall. A wooden stair ascended the south face, anchored on huge, rough-hewn beams sunk deep into the ice and frozen in place. Back and forth it switched, clawing its way upward, as crooked as a bolt of lightning. The Black Brothers assured him that it was much stronger than it looked.
but Tyrion's legs were cramping too badly for him to even contemplate the ascent. He went instead to an iron cage beside the well, clambered inside, and yanked hard on the bell rope 3 quick pulls. He had to wait what seemed an eternity, standing there inside the bars with a wall to his back, long enough for Tyrion to begin to wonder why he was doing this. He had just about decided to forget his sudden whim and go to bed when the cage gave a jerk and began to ascend. He moved upward slowly, by fits and starts at first, then more smoothly. The ground fell away beneath him. The cage swung, and Tyrion wrapped his hands around the iron bars. He could feel the cold of the metal even through his gloves. Morric had a fire burning in his room, he noted with approval, but the Lord Commander's tower was dark. The old bear had more sense than he did, it seemed. Then he was above the towers, still inching his way upward. Castle Black lay below him, etched in moonlight. You could see how stark and empty it was from up here. Windowless keeps, crumbling walls, courtyards choked with broken stone. Farther off, he could see the lights of Molestown, the little village half a league south along the King's Road, and here and there the bright glitter of moonlight on water where icy streams descended from the mountain heights to cut across the plains. The rest of the world was a bleak emptiness of windswept hills and rocky fields spotted with snow. Finally, a thick voice behind him said, "Seven Elves, it's the dwarf." And the cage jerked to a sudden stop and hung there, swinging slowly back and forth, the ropes creaking. "Bring him in, damn it!" There was a grunt and a loud groaning of wood as the cage slid sideways and then the wall was beneath him. Tyrion waited until the swinging had stopped before he pushed open the cage door and hopped down onto the ice. A heavy figure in black was leaning on the winch while a second held the cage with a gloved hand. Their faces were muffled in woolen scarves, so only their eyes showed, and they were plump with layers of wool and leather, black on black. "And what will you be wanting this time of night?" the one by the winch said. "A last look." The men exchanged sour glances. "Look all you want," the other one said. "Just take a care you don't fall off, little man. The old bear would have our hides." A small wooden shack stood under the great crane, and Tyrion saw the dull glow of a brazier and felt a brief gust of warmth when the winch men opened the door and went back inside. And then he was alone. It was bitingly cold up here, and the wind pulled at his clothes like an insistent lover. The top of the wall was wider than the King's Road often was, so Tyrion had no fear of falling, although the footing was slicker than he would have liked. The brothers spread crushed stone across the walkways, but the weight of countless footsteps would melt the wall beneath, so the ice would seem to grow around the gravel, swallowing it, until the path was bare again and it was time to crush more stone. Still, it was nothing that Tyrion could not manage. He looked off to the east and west, at the wall stretching before him a vast white road with no beginning and no end, and a dark abyss on either side. West, he decided, for no special reason, and he began to walk that way, following the pathway nearest the north edge, where the gravel looked freshest. His bare cheeks were ruddy with the cold, and his legs complained more loudly with every step, but Tyrion ignored them. The wind swirled around him, gravel crunched beneath his boots, while ahead the white ribbon followed the lines of the hills, rising higher and higher until it was lost beyond the western horizon. He passed a massive catapult, as tall as a city wall, its base sunk deep into the wall. The throwing arm had been taken off for repairs and then forgotten. It lay there, like a broken toy, half embedded in the ice. On the far side of the catapult, a muffled voice called out a challenge. "Who goes there? Halt!" Tyrion stopped. "If I halt too long, I'll freeze in place, John,"
he said as a shaggy pale shape slid toward him silently and sniffed at his furs.
Hello, ghost.
Jon Snow moved closer. He looked bigger and heavier in his layers of fur and leather, the hood of his cloak pulled down over his face.
Lannister, he said, yanking loose the scarf to uncover his mouth. This is the last place I would have expected to see you.
He carried a heavy spear tipped in iron, taller than he was, and a sword hung at his side in a leather sheath. Across his chest was a gleaming black war horn banded with silver.
This is the last place I would have expected to be seen, Tyrion admitted. I was captured by a whim. If I touch ghost, will it chew my hand off?
Not with me here, Jon promised. Tyrion scratched the white wolf behind the ears. The red eyes watched him impassively. The beast came up as high as his chest now. Another year, and Tyrion had the gloomy feeling he'd be looking up at him.
What are you doing here tonight, he asked, besides freezing your manhood off?
I have drawn night guard, Jon said. Again. Sir Alistair has kindly arranged for the watch commander to take a special interest in me. He seems to think that if they keep me awake half the night, I'll fall asleep during morning drill. So far, I have disappointed him. Tyrion grinned.
And has Ghost learned to juggle yet?
No, said Jon, smiling. But Gren held his own against Halder this morning, and Pip is no longer dropping his sword quite so often as he did.
Pip?
Pippa is his real name, the small boy with the large ears. He saw me working with Gren and asked for help. Thorn had never even shown him the proper way to grip a sword. He turned to look north. I have a mile of wall to guard. Will you walk with me?
If you walk slowly, Tyrion said.
The watch commander tells me I must walk to keep my blood from freezing, but he never said how fast. They walked, with Ghost pacing along beside Jon like a white shadow.
I leave on the morrow, Tyrion said.
I know. Jon sounded strangely sad.
I plan to stop at Winterfell on the way south if there's any message that you would like me to deliver.
Tell Rob that I am going to command the night's watch and keep him safe. So he might as well take up needlework with the girls and have Mickon melt down his sword for horseshoes.
Your brother is bigger than me, Tyrion said with a laugh. I decline to deliver any message that might get me killed.
Rickon will ask when I'm coming home. Try to explain where I've gone if you can. Tell him he can have all my things while I'm away. He'll like that. People seem to be asking a great deal of him today, Tyrion Lannister thought.
You could put all this in a letter, you know.
Rickon can't read yet. Bran... He stopped suddenly. I don't know what message to send Bran. Help him, Tyrion.
What help could I give him? I'm no maester to ease his pain. I have no spells to give him back his legs.
You gave me help when I needed it, Jon Snow said.
I gave you nothing,
Tyrion said. Words! Then give your words to Bran, too.
You're asking a lame man to teach a cripple how to dance, Tyrion said. However sincere the lesson, the result is likely to be grotesque.
Still, I know what it is to love a brother, Lord Snow. I will give Bran whatever small help is in my power. Thank you, my Lord of Lannister. He pulled off his glove and offered his bare hand. Friend, Tyrion found himself oddly touched.
Most of my kin are bastards, he said with a wry smile. But you're the first I've had to friend.
He pulled a glove off with his teeth and clasped Snow by the hand, flesh against flesh. The boy's grip was firm and strong. When he had donned his glove again, Jon Snow turned abruptly and walked to the low, icy northern parapet. Beyond him, the wall fell away sharply. Beyond him, there was only the darkness and the wild. Tyrion followed him, and side by side they stood upon the edge of the world. The Night's Watch permitted the forest to come no closer than half a mile of the north face of the wall.
The thickets of ironwood and sentinel and oak that had once grown there had been harvested centuries ago to create a broad swathe of open ground through which no enemy could hope to pass unseen. Tyrion had heard that elsewhere along the wall, between the three fortresses, the wildwood had come creeping back over the decades, that there were places where grey-green sentinels and pale-white weirwoods had taken root in the shadows of the wall itself. But Castle Black had a prodigious appetite for firewood, and here the forest was still kept at bay by the axes of the Black Brothers. It was never far, though. From up here, Tyrion could see it, the dark trees looming beyond the stretch of open ground like a second wall built parallel to the first, a wall of night. Few axes had ever swung in that black wood, where even the moonlight could not penetrate the ancient tangle of root and thorn and grasping limb. Out there the trees grew huge, and the ranger said they seemed to brood and knew not men. It was small wonder the Night's Watch named it the Haunted Forest. As he stood there and looked at all that darkness with no fires burning anywhere, with the wind blowing and the cold like a spear in his guts, Tyrion Lannister felt as though he could almost believe the talk of the others, the enemy and the night. His jokes of grumpkins and snarks no longer seemed quite so droll. "My uncle is out there," Snow said softly, leaning on his spear as he stared off into the darkness. "The first night they sent me up here, I thought Uncle Benjen will ride back tonight, and I'll see him first and blow the horn. He never came, though. Not that night, nor any night." "We'll give him time," Tyrion said. Far off to the north, a wolf began to howl. Another voice picked up the call, then another. Ghost cocked his head and listened. "If he doesn't come back," Jon Snow promised, "Ghost and I will go find him." He put his hand on the dire wolf's head.
"I believe you," Tyrion said.
But what he thought was,
"And who will go find you?" He shivered.
Arya. Her father had been fighting with the council again. Arya could see it on his face when he came to the table, late again, as he had been so often. The first course, a thick, sweet soup made with pumpkins, had already been taken away when Ned Stark strode into the small hall. They called it that to set it apart from the great hall, where the king could feast 1,000. But it was a long room with a high vaulted ceiling and bench space for 200 at its trestle tables. "My lord," Jorah said when Father entered. He rose to his feet, and the rest of the guard rose with him. Each man wore a new cloak, heavy grey wool with a white satin border. A hand of beaten silver clutched the woolen folds on each cloak and marked each wearer as men of the Hand's household guard. There were only 50 of them, so most of the benches were empty. "Be seated," Eddard Stark said. "I see you have started without me. I am pleased to know there are still some men of sense in this city." He signaled for the meal to resume. The servants began bringing out platters of ribs roasted in a crust of garlic and herbs. "The talk in the yard is that we shall have a tourney, my lord," Jorah said as he resumed his seat. "They say the knights will come from all over the realm to joust and feast in honor of your appointment as Hand of the King." Arya could see that her father was not very happy about that. "Do they also say this is the last thing in the world I would have wished?" Sansa's eyes had grown wide as the plates. "A tourney," she breathed. She was seated between Septa Mordane and Jane Paul, as far from Arya as she could get without drawing a reproach from her father. "Will we be permitted to go, Father?"
"Well, you know my feelings, Sansa. It seems I must arrange Robert's games and pretend to be honored for his sake. That does not mean I must subject my daughters to this folly."
Oh, please, Sansa said. I want to see. Septa Mordain spoke up.
Princess Mycella will be there, my lord, and her younger than Lady Sansa. All the ladies of the court will be expected at a grand event like this. And as the tourney is in your honor, it would look queer if your family did not attend.
Father looked pained. I suppose so. Very well, I shall arrange a place for you, Sansa. He saw Arya, for both of you. I don't care about their stupid tourney, Arya said. She knew Prince Joffrey would be there, and she hated Prince Joffrey. Sansa lifted her head. It will be a splendid event. You shan't be wanted. Anger flashed across Father's face. Enough, Sansa. More of that, and you will change my mind. I'm weary to death of this endless war you two are fighting. You are sisters. I expect you to behave like sisters. Is that understood? Sansa bit her lip and nodded. Arya lowered her face to stare sullenly at her plate. She could feel tears stinging in her eyes. She rubbed them away angrily, determined not to cry. The only sound was a clatter of knives and forks. "Pray excuse me," her father announced to the table. "I find I have small appetite tonight." He walked from the hall. After he was gone, Sansa exchanged excited whispers with Jane Poole. Down the table, Jorry laughed at a joke, and Hullan started in about horseflesh.
Your war horse now, he may not be the best one for the joust. Not the same thing, oh no, not the same at all.
The men had heard it all before. Desmond, Jax, and Hullan's son Harwin shouted him down together, and Porther called for more wine. No one talked to Arya. She didn't care. She liked it that way. She would have eaten her meals alone in her bedchamber if they let her. Sometimes they did, when Father had to dine with the king or some lord or the envoys from this place or that place. The rest of the time, they ate in Isola. Just him and her and Sansa. That was when Arya missed her brothers most. She wanted to tease Bran and play with baby Rickon, and have Rub smile at her. She wanted John to muss up her hair and call her little sister and finish her sentences with her. But all of them were gone. She had no one left but Sansa, and Sansa wouldn't even talk to her unless Father made her. Back at Winterfell, they had eaten in the Great Hall almost half the time. Her father used to say that a lord needed to eat with his men if he hoped to keep them. "Know the men who follow you," she heard him tell Rob once, "and let them know you. Don't ask a man to die for a stranger." At Winterfell, he always had an extra seat set at his own table, and every day a different man would be asked to join him. One night it would be Vaen Poole, and the talk would be coppers and bread stores and servants. The next time it would be Micken, and her father would listen to him go on about armor and swords and how hot a forge should be and the best way to temper steel. Another day it might be Hullan with his endless horse talk, or Septon Shale from the library, or Jory, or Sir Roderick, or even old Nan with her stories. Arya had loved nothing better than to sit at her father's table and listen to them talk. She had loved listening to the men on the benches, too, to free riders tough as leather, courtly knights and bold young squires, grizzled old men-at-arms. She used to throw snowballs at them and help them steal pies from the kitchen. Their wives gave her scones, and she invented names for their babies and played monsters and maidens and hide the treasure and come into my castle with their children. Fat Tom used to call her Arya Underfoot, because he said that was where she always was. She liked that a lot better than Arya Horseface. Only that was Winterfell, a world away, and now everything was changed. This was the first time they had supped with the men since arriving in King's Landing. Arya hated it. She hated the sounds of their voices now, the way they laughed, the stories they told. They'd been her friends. She'd felt safe around them. But now she knew that was a lie. They'd let the queen kill Lady,
That was horrible enough. But then the hound found Micah. Jane Poole had told Arya that he'd cut him up in so many pieces that they'd given him back to the butchers in a bag. And at first the poor man had thought it was a pig they'd slaughtered. And no one had raised a voice or drawn a blade or anything. Not Harwin, who always talked so bold, or Alan, who was going to be a knight, or Jory, who was captain of the guard. Not even her father. "He was my friend," Arya whispered into her plate, so low that no one could hear. Her rib sat there untouched, grown cold now, a thin film of grease congealing beneath them on the plate. Arya looked at them and felt ill. She pushed away from the table.
"Pray, where do you think you're going, young lady?"
Septa Mordaunt asked. "I'm not hungry." Arya found it an effort to remember her courtesies. "May I be excused, please?" she recited stiffly.
"You may not," the Septa said. "You have scarcely touched your food. You will sit down and clean your plate."
"You clean it." Before anyone could stop her, Arya bolted for the door as the men laughed and Septa Mordaunt called loudly after her, a voice rising higher and higher. Fat Tom was at his post guarding the door to the Tower of the Hand. He blinked when he saw Arya rushing toward him and heard the Scepter's shout.
"Here now, little one, hold on," he started to say, reaching.
But Arya slipped between his legs, and then she was running up the winding tower steps, her feet hammering on the stone, while Fat Tom huffed and puffed behind her. Her bedchamber was the only place that Arya liked in all of King's Landing. And the thing she liked best about it was the door, a massive slab of dark oak with black iron bands. When she slammed that door and dropped the heavy crossbar, nobody could get into her room. Not Septa Mordaunt or Fat Tom or Sansa or Jory or the Hound. Nobody. She slammed it now. When the bar was down, Arya finally felt safe enough to cry. She went to the window seat and sat there, sniffling, hating them all, and herself most of all. It was all her fault, everything bad that had happened. Sansa said so, and Jane too. Fat Tom was knocking on her door.
"Arya, girl, what's wrong?" he called out. "Are you in there?"
"No," she shouted. The knocking stopped. A moment later, she heard him going away. Fat Tom was always easy to fool. Arya went to the chest at the foot of her bed. She knelt, opened the lid, and began pulling her clothes out with both hands, grabbing handfuls of silk and satin and velvet and wool and tossing them on the floor. It was there, at the bottom of the chest, where she'd hidden it. Arya lifted it out, almost tenderly, and drew the slender blade from its sheath. Needle. She thought of Micah again, and her eyes filled with tears. Her fault. Her fault. Her fault. If she had never asked him to play at swords with her. There was a pounding at her door, louder than before.
"Arya Stark, you will open this door at once. Do you hear me?"
Arya spun around, with needle in her hand. "You'd better not come in here," she warned. She slashed at the air savagely.
"The Hand will hear of this,"
Septa Mordaunt raged.
"I don't care," Arya screamed. "Go away. You will rue this insolent behavior, young lady. I promise you that."
Arya listened at the door until she heard the sound of the Scepter's receding footsteps. She went back to the window, needle in hand, and looked down into the courtyard below. If only she could climb like Bran, she thought. She would go out the window and down the tower, run away from this horrible place, away from Sansa and Septa Mordaunt and Prince Joffrey, from all of them. Steal some food from the kitchens, take Needle and her good boots and a warm cloak. She could find Nymeria in the wild woods below the Trident, and together they'd return to Winterfell or run to Jon on the Wall. She found herself wishing that Jon was here with her now. Then maybe she wouldn't feel so alone. A soft knock on the door behind her
turned Arya away from the window and her dreams of escape. Arya, her father's voice called out, open the door. We need to talk. Arya crossed the room and lifted the crossbar. Father was alone. He seemed more sad than angry. That made Arya feel even worse. May I come in? Arya nodded, then dropped her eyes, ashamed. Father closed the door. Whose sword is that? Mine. Arya had almost forgotten needle in her hand. Give it to me. Reluctantly, Arya surrendered her sword, wondering if she would ever hold it again. Her father turned it in the light, examining both sides of the blade. He tested the point with his thumb. A bravo's blade, he said. Yet it seems to me that I know this maker's mark. This is Mikkon's work. Arya could not lie to him. She lowered her eyes. Lord Eddard Stark sighed. My 9-year-old daughter is being armed from my own forge, and I know nothing of it. The hand of the king is expected to rule the 7 kingdoms, yet it seems I cannot even rule my own household. How is it that you come to own a sword, Arya? Where did you get this? Arya chewed her lip and said nothing. She would not betray John, not even to their father. After a while, Father said, I don't suppose it matters, truly. He looked down gravely at the sword in his hands. This is no toy for children, least of all for a girl. What would Septima Dane say if she knew you were playing with swords? I wasn't playing, Arya insisted. I hate Septima Dane. That's enough. Her father's voice was curt and hard. The scepter is doing no more than his duty, though gods know you have made it a struggle for the poor woman. Your mother and I have charged her with the impossible task of making you a lady. I don't want to be a lady, Arya flared. I ought to snap this toy across my knee here and now and put an end to this nonsense. Needle wouldn't break, Arya said defiantly, but her voice betrayed her words. It has a name, does it? Her father sighed. Ah, Arya, you have a wildness in you, child. The wolf blood, my father used to call it. Lyanna had a touch of it, and my brother Brandon. More than a touch, but brought them both to an early grave. Arya heard sadness in his voice. He did not often speak of his father, or of the brother and sister who had died before she was born. Lyanna might have carried a sword if my lord father had allowed it. You remind me of her sometimes. You even look like her. Lyanna was beautiful, Arya said, startled. Everybody said so. It was not a thing that was ever said of Arya. She was, Eddard Stark agreed, beautiful and willful and dead before her time. He lifted the sword, held it out between them. Arya, what did you think to do with this needle? Who did you hope to skewer? Your sister? Septa Mordane? Do you know the first thing about sword fighting? All she could think of was the lesson John had given her. Stick them with the pointy end, she blurted out. Her father snorted back laughter. That is the essence of it, I suppose. Arya desperately wanted to explain, to make him see. I was trying to learn, but... Her eyes filled with tears. I asked Micah to practice with me. The grief came on her all at once. She turned away, shaking. I asked him, she cried. It was my fault. It was me. Suddenly her father's arms were around her. He held her gently as she turned to him and sobbed against his chest. No, sweet one, he murmured. Grieve for your friend, but never blame yourself. You did not kill the butcher's boy. That murder lies at the hound's door. Him and the cruel woman he serves. I hate them, Arya confided, red-faced, sniffling. A hound, and a queen, and a king, and Prince Joffrey. I hate them all. Joffrey lied. It wasn't the way he said. I hate Sansa, too. She did remember. She just lied so Joffrey would like her. We all lie, her father said.
Or did you truly think I'd believe that Nymeria ran off? Arya blushed guiltily. Jory promised not to tell. Jory kept his word, her father said with a smile. There are some things I do not need to be told. Even a blind man could see that wolf would never have left you willingly.
We had to throw rocks, she said miserably. I told her to run, to go, be free, that I didn't want her anymore. There were other wolves for her to play with. We heard them howling, and Jory said the woods were full of game, so she'd have deer to hunt. Only she kept following, and finally we had to throw rocks. I hit her twice. She whined and looked at me, and I felt so ashamed. But it was right, wasn't it? The queen would have killed her.
It was right, her father said, and even the lie was not without honour. He put needle aside when he went to Arya to embrace her. Now he took the blade up again and walked to the window, where he stood for a moment, looking out across the courtyard. When he turned back, his eyes were thoughtful. He seated himself on the window seat, needle across his lap. Arya, sit down. I need to try and explain some things to you. She perched anxiously on the edge of her bed. You are too young to be burdened with all my cares, he told her, but you are also a Stark of Winterfell. You know our words.
Winter is coming,
Arya whispered. The hard, cruel times, her father said. We tasted them on the Trident, child, and when Bran fell. You were born in the long summer, sweet one. You've never known anything else. But now the winter is truly coming. Remember the sigil of our house, Arya?
The dire wolf, she said, thinking of Nymeria. She hugged her knees against her chest, suddenly afraid.
Let me tell you something about wolves, child. When the snows fall and the white winds blow, the lone wolf dies, but the pack survives. Summer is the time for squabbles. In winter, we must protect one another, keep each other warm, share our strengths. So if you must hate, Arya, hate those who would truly do us harm. Septa Mordain is a good woman. And Sansa. Sansa is your sister. You may be as different as the sun and the moon, but the same blood flows through both your hearts. You need her, as she needs you, and I need both of you, gods help me. He sounded so tired that it made Arya sad. I don't hate Sansa, she told him, not truly. It was only half a lie. I do not mean to frighten you, but neither will I lie to you. We have come to a dark, dangerous place, child. This is not Winterfell. We have enemies who mean us ill. We cannot fight a war among ourselves. This willfulness of yours, the running off, the angry words, the disobedience. At home, these were only the summer games of a child. Here and now, with winter soon upon us, that is a different matter. It is time to begin growing up. I will, Arya vowed. She had never loved him so much as she did in that instant. I can be strong, too. I can be as strong as Rob. He held needle out to her, hilt first. Here. She looked at the sword with wonder in her eyes. For a moment she was afraid to touch it, afraid that if she reached for it, it would be snatched away again. But then her father said, Go on, it's yours. And she took it in her hand. I can keep it, she said, for true. For true, he smiled. If I took it away, no doubt I'd find a morning star hidden under your pillow within the fortnight. Try not to stab your sister, whatever the provocation. I won't, I promise. Arya clutched needle tightly to her chest, and her father took his leave. The next morning, as they broke their fast, she apologized to Septa Mordain and asked for her pardon. The Septa peered at her suspiciously, but father nodded. 3 days later, at midday, her father's steward, Vaughan Poole, sent Arya to the small hall. The trestle tables had been dismantled, and the benches shoved against the wall. The hall seemed empty, until an unfamiliar voice said,
"You are late, boy."
A slight man with a bald head and a great beak of a nose stepped out of the shadows, holding a pair of slender wooden swords.
"Tomorrow you will be here at midday."
He had an accent, the lilt of the free cities, Braavos perhaps, or Myr.
"Who are you?"
Arya asked.
"I am your dancing master."
He tossed her one of the wooden blades. She grabbed for it, missed, and heard it clatter to the floor.
"Tomorrow you will catch it. Now pick it up."
It was not just a stick, but a true wooden sword, complete with grip and guard and pommel. Arya picked it up and clutched it nervously with both hands, holding it out in front of her. It was heavier than it looked, much heavier than needle. The bald man clicked his teeth together.
"That is not the way, boy. This is not a great sword that is needing two hands to swing it. You will take the blade in one hand."
"It's too heavy," Arya said.
"It is heavy as it needs to be to make you strong and for balancing. A hollow inside is filled with lead, just so. One hand now is all that is needing."
Arya took her right hand off the grip and wiped her sweaty palm on her pants. She held the sword in her left hand. He seemed to approve.
"The left is good. All is reversed. It will make your enemies more awkward. Now you're standing wrong. Turn your body side face. Yes, so. You are as skinny as the shaft of a spear, do you know? That is good, too. The target is smaller. Now the grip. Let me see."
He moved closer and peered at her hand, prying her fingers apart, rearranging them.
"Just so, yes. Do not squeeze it so tight. No, the grip must be deft, delicate."
"What if I drop it?" Arya said.
"The steel must be part of your arm," the bald man told her. "Can you drop part of your arm?" "No." 9 years, Sirio Forel was the first sword to the Sea Lord of Braavos. He knows these things. Listen to him, boy."
It was the third time he had called her boy. "I'm a girl," Arya objected.
"Boy, girl," Sirio Forel said. "You are a sword. That is all."
He clicked his teeth together.
"Just so. This is the grip. You're not holding a battle axe. You're holding a needle,"
Arya finished for him, fiercely.
"Just so. Now we will begin the dance. Remember, child, this is not the iron dance of the Westeros we are learning, the knight's dance, hacking and hammering. No. This is the Braavos dance, the water dance, swift and sudden. All men are made of water. Do you know this? When you pierce them, the water leaks out and they die."
He took a step backward, raised his own wooden blade.
"Now, you will try to strike me."
Arya tried to strike him. She tried for 4 hours, until every muscle in her body was sore and aching, while Sirio Forel clicked his teeth together and told her what to do. The next day, their real work began. Daenerys.
"The Dothraki Sea," Sir Jorah Mormont said as he reined to a halt beside her on the top of the ridge. Beneath them, the plains stretched out immense and empty, a vast flat expanse that reached to the distant horizon and beyond. It was a sea, Danny thought. Past here, there were no hills, no mountains, no trees, no cities or roads, only the endless grasses, the tall blades rippling like waves when the wind blew. "It's so green," she said. "Here and now," Sir Jorah agreed. "You ought to see it when it blooms, all dark red flowers from horizon to horizon, like a sea of blood. Come the dry season, and the world turns the colour of old bronze. And this is only Hrana, child. There are 100 kinds of grass out there, grasses as yellow as lemon, and as dark as indigo. Blue grasses and orange grasses. Grasses like rainbows. Down in the Shadowlands, beyond Ashai, they say there are oceans of ghost grass, taller than a man on horseback, with stalks as pale as milk glass. It murders all the other grass and glows in the dark with the spirits of the damned. The Dothraki claim that someday ghost grass will cover the entire world, and then all life will end.
That thought gave Danny the shivers. I don't want to talk about that now, she said. It's so beautiful here. I don't want to think about everything dying.
As you will, Khaleesi,
Ser Jorah said respectfully. She heard the sound of voices and turned to look behind her. She and Mormont had outdistanced the rest of their party, and now the others were climbing the ridge below them. Her handmaiden Eri and the young archers of her Kaas were fluid as centaurs, but Viserys still struggled with the short stirrups and the flat saddle. Her brother was miserable out here. He ought never to have come. Magister Illyrio had urged him to wait in Pentos, had offered him the hospitality of his manse, but Viserys would have none of it. He would stay with Drogo until the debt had been paid, until he had the crown he had been promised.
And if he tries to cheat me, he will learn to his sorrow what it means to wake the dragon.
Viserys had vowed, laying a hand on his borrowed sword. Illyria had blinked at that and wished him good fortune. Danny realized that she did not want to listen to any of her brother's complaints right now. The day was too perfect. The sky was a deep blue, and high above them, a hunting hawk circled. The grass sea swayed and sighed with each breath of wind. The air was warm on her face, and Danny felt at peace. She would not let Viserys spoil it. Wait here, Danny told Ser Jorah. Tell them all to stay. Tell them I command it. The knight smiled. Ser Jorah was not a handsome man. He had a neck and shoulders like a bull, and coarse black hair covered his arms and chest so thickly that there was none left for his head. Yet his smiles gave Danny comfort.
You are learning to talk like a queen, Daenerys.
Not a queen, said Danny. A Khaleesi. She wheeled her horse about and galloped down the ridge alone. The descent was steep and rocky, but Danny rode fearlessly, and the joy and the danger of it were a song in her heart. All her life, Viserys had told her she was a princess, but not until she rode her silver had Daenerys Targaryen ever felt like one. At first it had not come easy. The Khalasar had broken camp the morning after her wedding, moving east towards Vaes Dothrak, and by the third day, Danny thought she was going to die. Saddle sores opening on her bottom, hideous and bloody, her thighs were chafed raw, her hands blistered from the reins, the muscles of her legs and back so racked with pain that she could scarcely sit. By the time dusk fell, her handmaids would need to help her down from her mount. Even the knights brought no relief. Khal Drogo ignored her when they rode, even as he had ignored her during their wedding, and spent the evenings drinking with his warriors and blood riders, racing his prized horses, watching women dance and men die. Danny had no place in these parts of his life. She was left to sup alone, or with Ser Jorah and her brother, and afterwards to cry herself to sleep. Yet every night, some time before dawn, Drogo would come to her tent and wake her in the dark, to ride her as relentlessly as he rode his stallion. He always took her from behind, Dothraki fashion, for which Danny was grateful. That way, her lord husband could not see the tears that wet her face, and she could use her pillow to muffle her cries of pain. When he was done, he would close his eyes and begin to snore softly, and Danny would lie beside him, her body bruised and sore, hurting too much for sleep. Day followed day, and night followed night, until Danny knew she could not endure a moment longer. She would kill herself rather than go on, she decided one night. Yet when she slept that night, she dreamt
the dragon dream again. Viserys was not in it this time. There was only her and the dragon. Its scales were black as night, wet and slick with blood. Her blood, Danny sensed. Its eyes were pools of molten magma, and when it opened its mouth, the flame came roaring out in a hot jet. She could hear it singing to her. She opened her arms to the fire, embraced it, let it swallow her whole, let it cleanse her and temper her and scour her clean. She could feel her flesh sear and blacken and slough away. She could feel her blood boil and turn to steam. And yet there was no pain. She felt strong and new and fierce. And the next day, strangely, she did not seem to hurt quite so much. It was as if the gods had heard her and taken pity. Even her handmaids noticed the change. Khaleesi, Jiqui said, what is wrong? Are you sick? I was, she answered, standing over the dragon's eggs that Illyrio had given her when she wed. She touched one, the largest of the three, running her hand lightly over the shell. Black and scarlet, she thought, like the dragon in my dream. The stone felt strangely warm beneath her fingers. Or was she still dreaming? She pulled her hand back nervously. From that hour onward, each day was easier than the one before it. Her legs grew stronger, her blisters burst, and her hands grew calloused. Her soft thighs toughened, supple as leather. The Carl had commanded the handmaid Iri to teach Danny to ride in the Dothraki fashion. But it was the filly who was the real teacher. The horse seemed to know her moods as if they shared a single mind. With every passing day, Danny felt surer in her seat. The Dothraki were a hard and unsentimental people, and it was not their custom to name their animals. So Danny thought of her only as the Silver. She had never loved anything so much. As the riding became less an ordeal, Danny began to notice the beauties of the land around her. She rode at the head of the Khalasar with Drogo and his blood riders, so she came to each country fresh and unspoiled. Behind them, the great horde might tear the earth and muddy the rivers and send up clouds of choking dust, but the fields ahead of them were always green and verdant. They crossed the rolling hills of Norvas, past terraced farms and small villages, where the townsfolk watched anxiously from atop white stucco walls. They forded three wide, placid rivers and a fourth that was swift and narrow and treacherous, camped beside a high blue waterfall, skirted the tumbled ruins of a vast dead city where ghosts were said to moan among blackened marble columns. They raced down Valyrian roads 1,000 years old and straight as a Dothraki arrow. For half a moon they rode through the forest of Cahor, where the leaves made a golden canopy high above them, and the trunks of the trees were as wide as city gates. There were great elk in that wood, and spotted tigers, and lemurs with silver fur and huge purple eyes. But all fled before the approach of the Khalasar, and Danny got no glimpse of them. By then, her agony was a fading memory. She still ached after a long day's riding, yet somehow the pain had a sweetness to it now. And each morning she came willingly to her saddle, eager to know what wonders waited for her in the lands ahead. She began to find pleasure even in her nights. And if she still cried out when Drogo took her, it was not always in pain. At the bottom of the ridge, the grasses rose around her, tall and supple. Danny slowed to a trot and rode out onto the plain, losing herself in the green, blessedly alone. In the Khalasar, she was never alone. Khal Drogo came to her only after the sun went down, but her handmaids fed her and bathed her and slept by the door of her tent. Drogo's blood riders and the men of her Khaz were never far, and her brother was an unwelcome shadow day and night. Danny could hear him at the top of the ridge, his voice shrill with anger as he shouted at Ser Jorah. She rode on, submerging herself deeper in the Dothraki Sea. The green swallowed her up. The air was rich with the scents of earth and grass, mixed with the smell of horseflesh and Danny's sweat and the oil in her hair. Dothraki smells. They seem to belong here. Danny breathed it all in, laughing. She had a sudden urge to feel the ground beneath her, to curl her toes in the thick black soil. Swinging down from her saddle, she let the silver graze while she pulled off her high boots. Viserys came upon her as suddenly as a summer storm, his horse rearing beneath him as he reined up too hard.
"You dare!" he screamed at her. "You give commands to me, to me!"
He vaulted off his horse, stumbling as he landed. His face was flushed as he struggled back to his feet. He grabbed her, shook her.
"Have you forgotten who you are? Look at you! Look at you!"
Danny did not need to look. She was barefoot, with oiled hair, wearing Dothraki riding leathers and a painted vest given her as a bride gift. She looked as though she belonged here. Viserys was soiled and stained in city silks and ringmail. He was still screaming,
"You do not command the dragon. Do you understand? I am the Lord of the Seven Kingdoms. I will not hear orders from some horse lord's slut. Do you hear?"
His hand went under her vest, his fingers digging painfully into her breast.
"Do you hear me?"
Danny shoved him away, hard.
Viserys stared at her, his lilac eyes incredulous.
She had never defied him, never fought back.
Rage twisted his features. He would hurt her now, and badly. She knew that. Crack!
The whip made a sound like thunder. The coil took Viserys around the throat and yanked him backward. He went sprawling in the grass, stunned and choking. The Dothraki riders hooted at him as he struggled to free himself. The one with the whip, Yon Jugo, rasped a question. Danny did not understand his words, but by then Irra was there, and Ser Jorah, and the rest of her cars.
"Jugo asks if you would have him dead, Khaleesi," Irra said.
"No," Danny replied, "no." Jugo understood that. One of the others barked out a comment, and the Dothraki laughed. Irra told her, "Quarro thinks you should take an ear to teach him respect." Her brother was on his knees, his fingers digging under the leather coils, crying incoherently, struggling for breath. The whip was tight around his windpipe. "Tell them I do not wish him harmed," Danny said. Irra repeated her words in Dothraki. Jogo gave a pull on the whip, yanking Viserys around like a puppet on a string. He went sprawling again. Free from the leather embrace, a thin line of blood under his chin where the whip had cut deep.
"I warned him what would happen, my lady," Ser Jorah Mormont said. "I told him to stay on the ridge as you commanded."
"I know you did," Danny replied, watching Viserys. He lay on the ground, sucking in air noisily, red-faced and sobbing. He was a pitiful thing. He'd always been a pitiful thing. Why had she never seen that before? There was a hollow place inside her where her fear had been.
"Take his horse," Danny commanded Ser Jorah. Viserys gaped at her. He could not believe what he was hearing,
nor could Danny quite believe what she was saying, yet the words came.
"Let my brother walk behind us back to the Khalasar."
Among the Dothraki, the man who does not ride was no man at all, the lowest of the low, without honor or pride.
"Let everyone see him as he is."
"No!"
Viserys screamed. He turned to Ser Jorah, pleading in the common tongue with words the horsemen would not understand.
"Hit her, Mormont! Hurt her! Your king commands it! Kill these Dothraki dogs and teach her!"
The exile knight looked from Danny to her brother, she barefoot, with dirt between her toes and oil in her hair, he with his silks and steel. Danny could see the decision on his face. "He shall walk, Khaleesi," he said. He took her brother's horse in hand while Danny remounted her silver. Viserys gaped at him and sat down in the dirt.